Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We turn our attention to the markets this week. U.S. CPI numbers reinforcing concerns about inflation.
And the financial stories that shape our world.
A really different reaction in the markets. More indications of just how hot the U.S. economy really is.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary.
Catherine Keating, CEO of BNY Mellon.
Sam Zell, Chairman and Founder of Equity Group Investment.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
An irresistible force meets an immovable object as inflation fever continues, but the central bank remedy to bring it down shakes global Wall Street to its core. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, special contributor Larry Summers on reacting to the bank crisis without giving up the fight against inflation.
I think it's appropriate, at least on current facts, to raise rates by 25 basis points.
The economist Zanny Beddoes on whether we should have seen it coming.
Well, I think we are seeing a realization that the banks are more fragile than people thought they were.
And Joshua Friedman of Canyon Valley Partners on what it all means for credit and for private equity. Any other week, we'd be talking about the ECB decision on Thursday to raise rates despite all the uncertainty surrounding the banks.
The Governing Council today decided to increase the three key ECB interest rates by 50 basis points.
And a Russian fighter jet forcing down a U.S. drone over the Black Sea.
This incident demonstrates a lack of competence in addition to being unsafe and unprofessional.
And China's lowering its growth target.
To achieve an around 5% growth, it's not an easy task. It's going to require redoubled efforts.
But this week, we watched as the foundations of the banking sector trembled in the face of the failure of Silicon Valley Bank.
There's never just one cockroach, like we've seen several banks here fall.
And of Signature Bank.
It was the second largest bank failure in U.S. history, followed by the third largest bank failure in U.S. history when Signature Bank was taken over as well.
And if that weren't enough, the systemically important Credit Suisse teetered as it first announced material weaknesses in its financial reporting controls, even as its chairman, Ulrich Körner, reassured Bloomberg's Francine Lacqua that it was not seeing fund outflows.
Material good inflows yesterday still. I had a client meeting which was very positive on that one. So far it's calm, but I think it's early days to look at this.
But by the end of the week, the Swiss National Bank had to step in with guarantees of liquidity as pressure built for some strategic resolution for Switzerland's second largest bank. And the hits just kept on coming as First Republic Bank came under siege, prompting Secretary Yellen to put together a group of banks to inject $30 billion in deposits into the bank, which as of Friday's close did not appear to have stopped the doubts. And as we head into the weekend now, markets are reacting to reports of UBS possibly stepping in to help with problems at Credit Suisse. Through it all, equities held up reasonably well. The S&P 500 ended up the week up 1.4%. The Nasdaq was up 4.4%. Investors flocked to the relative safety of bonds, taking the yield on the 10-year down 3 basis points, ending the week just over 3.4%, and the yield on the 2-year fell over 7 basis points to wind up just over 3.8%. To take us through it all, we welcome now Peter Krause. He's chairman and CEO of Aperture Investors. So welcome back, Peter. Great to have you here.
Good to be here, David.
So as we sit here, it's hard to know exactly what to address because it's moving. It's moving on both sides of the Atlantic with Credit Suisse, UBS, maybe over there. We've still got New Republic and other issues here. So as an investor, what do you do in these circumstances?
Yeah, look, it's very difficult. Investing is always a challenge, but in these markets, it's even more difficult. Risk is hard to take right now because if we really don't know where to take the risk, it's very difficult to put the risk on. So I think right now in today's markets, probably investors shouldn't be committing more to a particular risk position. I'm not sure they should reduce their risk because it's hard to know where to reduce the risk. None of us thought the 2-year was going to rally 100 basis points in less than 7 days. That's a dramatic, dramatic move. And none of us had any thought that, in fact, these banks were as unstable as they are. So I think at the present time, if I was investing incremental dollars, I'd probably have it in cash.
So as a practical matter, what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank and other places seemed to be a mismatch. A mismatch with respect to duration and respect to liquidity as you had long-term treasuries and other securities matched up against deposits people could withdraw right away. Where might there be similar mismatches, do you think, in the system, either in the banking system or beyond the banking system?
No, I think that's an excellent point. I think one of the challenges that the world has, this is not just a U.S. issue, is that for 10-plus years, interest rates have been very benign, inflation benign, volatility benign, and people have gotten comfortable with that. And so they've invested more money than they probably would historically into private assets, into public private equity, into private credit, and places in which they don't have liquidity. And now that interest rates are much, much higher in the front end, that cost of that liquidity is actually significant. And what we're seeing is a disintermediation of cash moving to where you can get 5% in short rates, whereas before you were getting zero. So yes, it's happening in the banking system. It's happening any place that has actually benefited from very low rates and low volatility. It's happening in the insurance business, where actually people who have insurance policies are saying, well, if I actually terminate my insurance policy and buy a new one, or actually buy a public security like a bond, I might get a better return. So we're going to see this continue to roll through the economic environment, and it's not over yet. And it's going to continue.
Part of the problem is marking to market. We haven't had it in, obviously, we've now learned the banking sector when it comes to some of these long-term treasuries. You've been on Wall Street Week before talking about in some of the private markets, private credit, private equity, things like that. How does that work its way through the system? Because sooner or later, if it's less worth less, we have to recognize that.
Yeah, I think that that's right. Look, what we sort of don't want is we don't want people with private assets to be forced to sell. Because they're not liquid, they ultimately will be sold at significant discounts, and the buyers of them are going to charge a lot for the liquidity. So it would be better if people who had those assets could hold them, but you're right, they're valued at rates that are, or levels that are probably higher than what their actual value is, and so we have to sort of engineer a change over time. So foundations, endowments, pension plans, any investor that has a sizable amount of private equity or private capital is going to have to figure out where to take their incremental dollars and invest them in public securities. And I think another issue that people have is they spend out of these foundations or endowments. So if your private equity investment is not actually selling companies and producing cash, then you're going to have to take that cash from the public side, which is going to put more pressure on that unequal or imbalance ratio. So I think this is, again, not going to get solved over the short run, and it could create some acute cases in which people have to sell these assets.
What does this tell the Fed? We've got a Fed meeting coming up next week. We had the ECB this week stay the course as it was anticipated with the 50 basis point increase. What does it say to the Fed? Does the Fed need to be worried about financial stability at this point?
Fed is worried about financial stability. They've proved that over the weekend. They did exactly what they should have done, which was to stabilize the two banking situations that the FDIC took over, and the transaction that you discussed earlier, where large U.S. New York banks put money into First Republic. Having said that, inflation is still very high. And we have to think about the fact that inflation affects the broad economy, not just the banks. And if we don't continue to fight inflation, then the bill we're going to have to pay at the end is going to be even bigger. So I think that the liquidity that was created by the bank actions over the weekend created space for the Fed to actually continue to take rates up by 25 basis points. Will they continue to watch the banking situation more carefully? Of course they will. That could change in the future. If a systemic bank fails, that may actually change the Fed's position. But for right now, I think the Fed probably moves 25 basis points.
Would you expect going forward investors would be a little less willing to put it in private and maybe stick with the public market?
Yeah, I do think the cost of liquidity has now gone up dramatically. And where it was kind of a no-brainer to put money in private assets, given what you would get in public assets or certainly in short-dated public assets, that's changed dramatically. And so I do think on the margin for two reasons. One, the rebalancing issue we discussed, and two is the relative attractiveness of the yields of public securities versus private securities. I also think that there is going to be a reckoning in the private capital or the private credit world where the loans that have been made over the last 10 years in a very benign credit environment. People look at the credit history of those assets and see very few losses and feel comfortable with that. That could change. And if people then begin to understand, well, those populations of loans are not quite as free from credit risk as I thought, that will also make people think a little bit more about putting money in the public side versus the private side.
What does this mean for, if I can call it this, the real economy? I mean, for example, to be very direct with you, is a recession more likely today than it was a week ago?
Yes, to be very direct with you. I think that the Fed has been saying, again, since it started raising rates, they want to restrict financial conditions. If you restrict financial conditions, by definition, you have to slow growth. Of course, the Fed is trying to slow growth without creating a recession. That is a very hard thing to do. With the banking crisis, you're probably also seeing financial conditions both loosen as a result of the Fed's action, but also tighten as a result of regional banks husbanding their cash and not lending as aggressively and worrying more about credit risk and therefore on the margin probably not lending. So I suspect on the real economy, by the end of the year, there will be a significant slowing, potential recession, and that's what we need because we're not going to get inflation down unless that happens.
Peter, so great to have you here again. That's Peter Krause of Aperture Investments. Coming up, economist editor-in-chief Zanny Beddoes joins us about yet another banking crisis and what we may risk by counting on the government to make it all go away. This is Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. It has been quite a week in the markets and particularly triggered by some crises in several banks. But now it's time to take a step back and maybe think about broader consequences of what we have seen this week. And to help us do that, we welcome now Zanny Minton-Beddoes. She is editor-in-chief of The Economist. So, Zanny, welcome back. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back here.
So you had you were covering the 2008-2009 great financial crisis. Do you have PTSD?
I certainly have a sense of deja vu. I mean, as you're right, I lived in Washington throughout that crisis, and I'm here. I was here in the U.S. This last weekend when the whole news broke about Silicon Valley Bank, and there was definitely a sense of deja vu. It's not on the scale yet, but it's also, I think, more systemic than people thought even a week ago. So I think we are seeing a realization that the banks are more fragile than people thought they were. Because after the 2008 financial crisis, and we can talk about this, but there was a huge amount of regulation and recapitalization and focus on strengthening the banks. But two things kind of we've now realized happened since then. One is that some of that regulatory framework was rolled back in 2017 and 18. And so Silicon Valley Bank would have been required to have much more rigorous supervision and to have had a kind of what's called a plan for its own demise, which the systemically important big banks have to have. And the original rules were that any bank bigger than with assets more than 50 billion would have to do that. That was raised to 250 billion, and so Silicon Valley Bank and others were no longer subject to that rigor. Had they been subject to it, this might not have happened. Secondly, and more importantly, the whole reorganization after 2000 and 2009 was designed to focus on problems of credit because that was the cause of the financial crisis. Inflation was low. In fact, people worried about deflation. No one worried about duration risk. No one worried about what happened to the value of, treasuries on banks' balance sheets when interest rates rose very sharply. That wasn't part of the thinking in 2009, 2010, when these regulatory reforms were done. Mm-hmm. And now we're in an environment where we've had, obviously, the fastest interest rate rise in decades, and we're seeing the consequences that actually these large holdings of government bonds, which were deemed to be part of making banks safer, are less safe than you thought because the banks have, effectively, if you mark them to market, they have big losses on them.
At the same time, we did have the Sunday announcement that basically said everything's going to be fine. We'll back up all the deposits no matter what. Everything seems to be systemic. The government steps in, makes it all better.
We did have that. And that's the, and I think when we look back at this episode, that is going to be the extraordinary development that on Sunday, not only were all depositors in those two banks bailed out, and of course, there was an FDIC limit of 250,000. That's, exemption made, all depositors bailed out. But in addition, the Fed instituted for 1 year, supposedly, a facility that banks could get liquidity at the par value of any treasuries and any government bonds that they hold. And the idea of a lender of last resort is to lend freely, quickly, against good collateral and at a punitive rate. But what we've seen really in the last few decades actually, has been an expansion of the Federal Reserve's kind of definition of what being a lender of last resort is, lending against much more collateral, lending more freely, becoming, after 2008, 2009, people talked of the Fed as a market maker of last resort, much broader. And what happened last Sunday was a very big shift because, in effect, it wasn't imposing any haircut on the bank's ability to borrow. They can borrow at par, which meant, in effect, they're getting subsidized by the Federal Reserve for their liquidity. And it's supposed to be a one-year facility. I don't know. Those kind of one-year facilities have a habit of changing. And that's a big shift in what the Fed does.
Zanny, it's so great to have you back on Wall Street Week. Thank you so much for being here. That's Zanny Minton-Beddoes of The Economist. Welcome now, Dave Gitlin. He's chairman and CEO of Carrier Global Corporation, and he joins us now. Thank you so much for being here with us on Wall Street Week. So we've had a busy week in the markets. A lot has gone on, triggered really by the sort of banking crisis, started with Silicon Valley Bank. I wonder for you, who runs a company that actually makes things, sells things in the real world, what effect does it have on you?
Well, first, the good news is that we have no material exposure to the regional banks. The banks involved, particularly the more broadly, the regional banks, so we're protected there. Our relationships are with the bulge bracket banks.
So rates are lower, but do you see any tightening of credit? Do you see any reluctance to extend credit at this point? Is that picking up at all? Or do you have to anticipate that possibility?
We have to anticipate that possibility. We haven't seen that yet. But rates coming down is overall a positive thing for our market because, you know, we look at some of the rates going up has had a dulling effect on the new housing market. So we should see some benefit in housing as rates start to come down. And our larger customers on the property side, as rates come down, that'll be a positive thing for commercial construction as well.
We have the Federal Reserve meeting next week, and there's a lot of debate about what they're likely to do. Talk about the other side of this equation. We're seeing the situation with the banks, a real need to support them. At the same time, we do have inflation. We're still getting inflation numbers on. How does that affect Carrier's business?
Well, if you're a company that has the ability to raise price and keep price, but also reduce costs, that spread can be very beneficial. So we look over the last 18 months, in many of our businesses, we've raised price 6 times. So we've been coming off very significant price increases. We raised price over $1.5 billion last year on a base of $20 billion. So we realized last year over 7.5% of price increases. While we have been experiencing inflation, we look at this year, inflation's not over. We came out with new price increases in January to kind of keep pace with the inflationary pressures that we see. But at the same time, we will be brutally tenacious on taking costs out of the business. We've reduced G&A from 9% to 7%. We're going very aggressively after working with our supply chain partners to really partner with suppliers that want to be on the journey with us to take costs out. We're going back after the basics of getting productivity in our factories. So maintain increased price as appropriate and then aggressively reduce costs.
Are you facing much pressure on the labor side?
We are. It's mostly acute in the United States. We don't have as many, you know, we have about 55,000 people, 80% of them are outside the United States, and most of the labor pressures we see still are in the United States, but we're starting to see some loosening there.
Where are the customers right now, and maybe where are they moving to? How is your business changing?
We look both geographically and by vertically. Geographically, you know, it does look like slower growth in the United States and Europe, but I will tell you, I was just in Saudi last week. The opportunity for infrastructure spend in Saudi Arabia is tremendous. It's a once-in-a-generation opportunity. We met with the PIF that has more than $700 billion that they're investing, and with the giga projects that they're investing in, they're going to invest more than $700 billion in NEOM, in Roshan, a housing project. So we want to be front and center as they build out significant infrastructure in Saudi Arabia. India looks very encouraging right now, so we want to invest very strongly in India. And I think China's going to surprise to the upside. There is this geopolitical cloud between the United States and Europe and China. But I will tell you that if you get beyond the cloud and you look in the trenches, there is really strong opportunity in China. And what we've done in China is shift our focus from property and real estate over to the industrial and infrastructure side. It was 70-30 one way. Now it's 70% I&I infrastructure and industrial. So we see a positive opportunity in China. And then we look by vertical. We just got to shift for where there's more opportunity. So data center strong. The CHIPS Act is bringing more investment into infrastructure and industrials in the United States. We look at low-end on the real, on certain parts of real estate look very encouraging. So we have an ability to shift some of our focus, and we're landing some very encouraging deals.
Here in the United States, you mentioned sustainability earlier. Tell us about the Inflation Reduction Act, some of the other issues, such as the bipartisan infrastructure bill. What is that doing to your business?
It's significant. You know, you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, $370 billion is going to be spent on clean energy, and we expect to be a big recipient. There's going to be a $2,000 incentive to go to heat pumps. Heat pumps is a very significant trend in the United States. 35% of all of our split systems that we sell for air conditioning for homes today are heat pumps. So if you can use that $2,000 incentive to shift from not only cooling only to a heat pump, but use it to shift to a variable speed, more energy efficient heat pump, that will have a very significant impact.
Dave, thank you so much for being on Wall Street. We're really glad to have you here. That's Dave Gitlin. He is the chairman and CEO of Carrier Global Corporation. Coming up, we wrap up a wild week with our special contributor, Larry Summers of Harvard. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg. Street Week. I'm David Westin. We're joined once again now by our very special contributor here on Wall Street Week. He is Larry Summers, of course, of Harvard. So, Larry, there are so many things to cover. It's hard to know where to start. But let's go through a few of them and how you would be looking at it if you were sitting in one of those policymaking decisions positions that you've had in the past. First of all, at the very end of the week on Friday, we had SVB Financial, that's the parent company of Silicon Valley Bank, declare bankruptcy here in New York City. And the bonds, as I understand, initially actually went up. What do you make of that?
Bankruptcy seems like the right thing for a company that's insolvent and the government is resolving it. Worried me to see those bonds go up. I don't understand why whatever money is going to the bondholders that the bondholders are looking at isn't instead being committed to defray the government's liability for depositors. I hope somebody's looked carefully at all the executive compensation arrangements and that any deferred compensation has been wiped out for SVB executives, whether it's coming from the bank or it's coming from the holding company, wherever it's coming out. That was the president's clear commitment. And I'd be a little concerned based on what I'm seeing, but obviously you have to respect the rule of law. And I don't know all the legal details.
Larry, you've been concerned about contagion. A lot of people have all week long. We had the First Republic Bank situation, and then overnight Thursday night, we had Secretary Yellen apparently make an arrangement with Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan for an infusion of $30 billion in deposits into the bank. What do you think about that?
Well, it was J.P. Morgan and a number of other banks who were apparently corralled by the secretary and by J.P. Morgan. I don't know what to make of it. The government has committed to put money in there at par, above the market value of securities, for a year. The fact that the banks made a commitment for 120 days so they can get out well ahead of the government at a interest rate that we don't yet know what it is, with what the understandings in the agreement with the Treasury are. I suppose the fact that everybody's acting will make people a little more confident, but it made me nervous. This was not an objective private sector assessment to have confidence in First Republic. So I'm not sure what to make of it. It seemed a little corporatist and deal-based between the government and big banks to me. But we'll have to see how it unfolds. And I hope there'll be total transparency on all the understandings.
What does all this mean for the central banks, particularly the Federal Reserve, as we look toward a decision next week, coming on the heels of the ECB? And when you saw what Madame Lagarde did this week.
I think Madame Lagarde was terrific. She did three very important things. She showed that you can carry through on necessary anti-inflation monetary policy even when there are financial strains. She made very clear that with two different problems, inflation and financial stability, you can use two different instruments to respond to those problems and not sacrifice on the inflation dimension. And she ended forward guidance. And I hope in many ways that will be a role model for the Fed. Forward guidance has mostly, since rates got off the zero floor, been an unfortunate model. I think we can use policy directed at standing behind depositors separately from monetary policy. And I think it's appropriate, at least on current facts, and they're changing very quickly these days, but on current facts, to raise rates by 25 basis points. So that's where I would be coming down. I do think that the Fed should not allow financial dominance, but does, of course, need to recognize that slower credit is going to be the result of that and assess it into its macroeconomic forecast. But as I read the economic evidence, the slowing of credit is not nearly as much
as the amount that the Fed has, that the market has taken out of its expectations of how the Fed is going to tighten. So I hope the Fed can move forward 25 basis points.
So, Larry, I understand your point, I think, about market dominance. We don't want to have that. At the same time, is it exactly right to believe, as Madame Lagarde does, that, in fact, using one of those policy instruments does not affect the other? And what I'm talking about is price stability and financial stability. Didn't we not see this week perhaps some evidence that when you go after price stability, you actually can affect financial stability?
You can. The way to deal with that is to adjust the other policy instrument by standing behind the affected institution. If I lose weight, it affects how well my clothes fit, but that's not an argument against losing weight. It's an argument for going to the tailor. And that's the same principle as using policy instruments to respond to financial concerns. I think it would be very unfortunate if, out of solicitude for the banking system, the Fed were to slow down its rate of interest increase beyond what was appropriate given the credit contraction. It would raise inflation expectations on the one hand, and I suspect many people would feel that if the Fed was scared, they should be as well. And so, ironically, it could both raise inflation expectations and contract the economy.
Larry, what did this week mean for financial regulation? And I really, I guess I'm asking two questions. How well we're doing it, because there are a lot of people really questioning, particularly the San Francisco Fed and its regulation, its oversight of Silicon Valley Bank. But number two, our confidence in the regulators. You saw the report that reportedly, at least, Chair Powell delayed the announcement about what was being done with Silicon Valley Bank because he wanted to take out any reference to problems with regulatory authorities.
Look, It's a mistake to rush to judgment when you don't know all the facts. But it sure looks like this was an egregious failure of supervision. We had hugely rapid growth in deposits. We had a obvious mismatch in duration. And it sure doesn't look like the supervisors at the San Francisco Fed were on top of the situation. Again, we don't know everything yet, but clearly this needs to be a cause for some soul searching within the Federal Reserve System. We have to be careful, David. The central irony of financial crisis is that it's caused by excessive lending, and it's resolved by more lending. And so we need to be careful at, in the very short run, throwing the book at all the regional banks, because that may exacerbate a credit crunch that we don't want to have. For the longer term, I think we need to think very carefully about whether we want to have this idea of market discipline from depositors. Should a $5 million startup be in the position of trying to evaluate the creditworthiness of a bank where it just wants to hold cash so that it can meet its payroll? I think the answer to that question is no. And so I hope we move to, over time, a financial system in which basic cash deposits sit in treasury bills or sit in institutions that intermediate them into treasury bills, and we separate the risk-taking function more securely than we do right now from the liquidity provision function. But that's for the long run. It's going to take a huge amount of thought. But there are very profound conceptual questions raised here. But right now, it's looking to me like the idea of market discipline from depositors just isn't a very strong idea.
Larry, thank you so much. Quite an important week to have you here on Wall Street Week. Thank you. That's Larry Summers of Harvard. Coming up, it was a week that cried out for leadership. And we get a lesson on transformative leadership from former Bridgewater CEO Dave McCormick, who's seen it from the best. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA, SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Our one more thought this week comes from Dave McCormick, a man who's run for the Senate in Pennsylvania, run Bridgewater, served with Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson during the Great Financial Crisis, and commanded troops in Operation Desert Storm. This week, Dave published his book on what he has learned and about the course correction he believes we need to make. The book is Superpower in Peril, A Battle Plan to Renew America. And in the end, it comes down to what Dave calls transformational leadership. One of the main themes of the book is transformational leadership, the need for transformational leadership. You've gotten the opportunity to lead as well as observe leaders through your career at West Point, in Desert Storm, in the Treasury Department, at Bridgewater. Draw from that and give us an example or two of people you thought were exceptional leaders or moments of exceptional leadership.
Yeah, well, you know, you talk about the of transforming the country, and the motivation for the book was, you know, taking the country in the right direction. And you could have all the great ideas in the world, but if you don't have leaders that, first of all, can win elections, so we need leaders who can win elections and then take those ideas in our republic and make them reality, then you're not going to go anywhere. And so I talk about the kind of leadership we need, and, you know, there's so many definitions of leadership. And despite having grown up in all these places and studied leadership, it's an amorphous concept. And so I tried to outline four things that I think are so critical to leadership. One's vision. You have to have a sense of where you're headed. Ronald Reagan was the best example of that, the simplicity, the clarity. And when we talk about courage, we talk about the courage to run up the hill or go into combat. We have so many courageous military, but there's courage that goes well beyond that. It's the courage to stand alone in pursuit of your convictions. It's the courage to make tough decisions. The third is humility. And Benjamin Franklin wrote a lot about leadership, but humility was the area that he spent a lot of time on. And I think that one's critical, because humility allows you to recognize you're often going to be wrong. It allows you to draw in others. It allows you to learn from and get better because of your mistakes. And we see this too rarely among leaders, because, you know, you start to be the leader and all of a sudden people keep telling you how smart you are and they laugh at your jokes. And keeping that humility through the course of your leadership journey is really critical. And then the final one I talk about is caring. And, you know, I don't think we see enough of this today, but people sense when you're in it for something bigger than yourself and in it for them and to bring them along. And those are the things in my career. In terms of the humility, Hank Paulson sticks out in my mind because Hank, I worked for him during the financial crisis, and he, you know, we got a lot wrong. And, you know, when you're in a crisis, you're going to try to do things and you learn from the feedback you get and you make mistakes and the ability to evolve quickly in the middle of a crisis, get feedback, respond, and not have your ego tied up into, oh, we decided to do this, therefore we're going to stick to it. I think really, in many ways, saved the country because he was adaptable. And here he is, you know, a bigger than life figure, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, the Treasury Secretary, you know, a remarkable leader, but one who constantly asked himself whether he was wrong and constantly made changes when he thought he was. And he's one of the people that jumps out in my mind as a gracious and successful leader.
That was Dave McCormick, author of Superpower in Peril. That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.